Can the tension between human rights and the Bible's teaching on divorce, marriage, and sanctity of life coexist in Northern Ireland?
Repeat the question again, if you would.
Can the tension between human rights and the Bible's teaching on divorce, marriage, and sanctity of life coexist in Northern Ireland?
Yes, they sort of have to, don't they? So the question is, how is the coexistence to be reached? In the sense that, and let me just sort of spin a bit the different dimensions of it, in the sense that the Bible can be interpreted as prohibiting divorce. Let's assume that that's the case. And it would be, I think, probably contrary to human rights not to have a system of divorce by this time. So the tension only exists, I think, and I suspect that I'm beginning now to get on into unpopular territory. The tension only exists if the assumption is that what the Bible teaches is to be imposed on those who don't believe in it. One of the, I think, critical dimensions of human rights, which I think is valuable and right, is that we should have freedom of thought, and we should be free to choose within constraints our own path of life. So the reason why this becomes problematic is that clearly some moral principles are included in the law, but they're included in the law by virtue of a democratic process. They're not included in the law by virtue of a theocratic process. That's what we resist in ISIS. And so I think the tension only exists if you assume an imposition of a set of beliefs on another set of persons that don't believe those. Does that answer the question?
I think so. Does anybody want to come back on that? Yeah. That it, if you have a certain view of life, what you were describing in your talk as a particularly clear worldview, then you're not in a position to impose that on everyone.
I mean, let's take another example, which is I suspect in terms of the debate out in the world is more controversial than divorce, which would be abortion. So, to what extent? So there was a statement, for example, by Benedict a couple of years before he died, where he regretted that there was decriminalization of abortion. That was a puzzling move, as far as I could see. And it was puzzling for the following reason. So it was puzzling because the assumption seemed to be that the criminal law should be used to impose moral beliefs of a highly controversial nature. And that seems to me highly questionable in a democracy, in a pluralistic democracy. But it was questionable in another respect, which is more interesting in some ways. The assumption was that, let's assume that abortion is morally wrong. Let's assume that. That the way in which one could best protect the unborn, for example, was by use of the criminal law. And I have to say, I mean, most lawyers would begin to question that for a whole set of reasons. that are to do with the nature of law. So, for example, it might be that the effect of decriminalization is to protect more fetuses. Right? It may be that, for example, empirical evidence, let's assume for a minute that empirical evidence establishes that decriminalization actually protects more fetuses than criminalization. Let's assume that. Does that mean that one then should question the use of criminalization? But then you're deeply into empirics. Or, for example, do you think that the purpose of the criminal law is to send messages or to actually achieve a result? Is it instrumental or is it expressive? Now, these are all deeply interesting and problematic questions within law. What religion has to do with any of this, I have no idea. I mean, the idea that, I have to say, my Pope is going to tell me that the criminal law should be instrumental versus expressive or the other way around, I don't see why it's got anything to do with him, to be honest. He's not a jurisprude. He does not understand that criminal law can play very different functions in very different societies, etc., etc. So the question about whether abortion is immoral or not, then that's in his territory. But the question of what to do about it gets you into deep problems of public policy and deeply both utilitarian and instrumental considerations that are, it seems to me, entirely outside his purview. Now, that probably means I'm about to be excommunicated.
Let me go with another question there. I really want to ask you the question about the dialogue you're talking about,
right,
as well, because how can competing definitions of human rights and human dignity get into conversation with each other?
Right.
Where does that happen?
Well, I mean, interestingly, it happens, I think, it happens here, for a start. I mean, this is an extremely good, I'm not just trying to be, you know, to be nice to you all, but this is precisely the kind of circumstance, it seems to me, in which this kind of dialogue does and should take place. And it seems to me there should be an awful lot more of it. I mean, we were talking earlier on about the kind of Nolanization of Northern Ireland discourse, where, you know, everything has to be fitted into a Twitter feed. And that seems to me the impoverishment of public discourse. We're talking about immensely important and serious questions, and that's not going to happen in a Twitter feed. So you need this kind of discourse, and it has to be sustained. And I debated with myself, so how far was I going to take an approach which was not an approach I would take in the context of an academic discussion? And I thought, no, I'm going to take a straightforward academic, high-level discussion, because it seems to me appropriate to treat your audience seriously in terms of engaging in that kind of debate. And sometimes this is really hard and tough stuff. Equally, you know, if I'm sitting in the audience and I'm listening to theology, then it's tough. But if I'm going to engage in a discussion about it, then it behoves me to engage in terms of the understanding that people have at the highest level. So in terms of how the discourse happens, it happens in places like this. But it also happens in courts. So, you know, the idea that, for example, you know, we're sitting, and I know there's going to be a question later on about Ashers that isn't really, it's ostensibly about Ashers, but really is. These kinds of discussions about, for example, the balance between freedom of expression and non-discrimination rights, that are clearly the stuff of politics and clearly the stuff of, you know, educated dinner party conversation, are also precisely the kinds of issues that occur in court as well. And so, you know, don't be misled in terms of, you know, television presentations of what happens in court. That one, it's all about criminal law, and two, it's all about manipulation and, you know, a sudden piece of evidence coming in that makes everything all right. Most of serious appellate discussions are about these kinds of issues nowadays, at least in the human rights context. And so what I'm suggesting is that just as and I mean this, you know, absolutely as a central part of the argument, just as lawyers and judges should be more aware of and more sophisticated about religious understandings of things, and they're generally not, but that also means that those who are on the religious side need also to understand what's going on in law. And if you're going to engage, then you need to engage on a level of being informed about what is possible and what's not. What are institutional considerations and what are moral considerations? How the whole thing happens. And I'm strongly suggesting that that dialogue, therefore, should take place not just in places like this, but that there should be a more engagement with what's going on in the law courts. That it shouldn't be simply pushed to a professional ambit, that it should be something that you should be understanding and engaging with. You know, last moan, right? I'm one of the Ramoners, I'm afraid, in many ways. But I'll have another moan. And the moan is about the quality of our reporting, both news, written news, and broadcast news, which in any area that I know about is in the main pathetic. I mean, pathetic not just in UK terms, but I'd say particularly pathetic in Northern Irish terms, where a lot of these questions that are absolutely central to political debate are simply not covered with a degree of sophistication that they need to be in order for people who are taking their news and taking their the basis for the debate from newspapers or from the press. They are being shortchanged in a way that I think we need to remind journalists that they have a responsibility and that they are shortchanging it.
Which leads me to ask, Chris, how would an intelligent Christian person access the kind of reporting or the kind of reflection on those issues here in Northern Ireland? We're not going to get it in the local press.
It's tough.
What would we read? Where would we go?
It's really tough. I mean, there used to be magazines that I suspect many of us read and criticized, you know, magazines like Fortnight or whatever, where there tended to be better public debate. But with the collapse of those kinds of news outlets, for very good commercial reasons, people just didn't buy them. It's very difficult because most of the news that you're getting is actually, and the comment that you're getting is either American or English, and some of the debates in Northern Ireland are quite as sophisticated, but also different from what's going on in either the States or in Ireland, south of the border, or in the UK. So it's a real difficulty. I really don't know.
Let me jump right in with the question.
Sorry, I'm going on.
Yeah, it's fascinating. To what extent can common ground be found in sexual equality laws vis-a-vis religious equality law?
Yeah, so so one of the really difficult areas in human rights is conflicts of rights. So in one sense, the usual sort of the ordinary conflict, which doesn't engage conflicts of rights, is a conflict between, for example, the public interest and rights. And in general, therefore, rights will trump the public interest unless there's a really good reason why it shouldn't. And this is called the proportionality analysis. Right? That is, constraints on rights should be justified if you're going to constrain rights. And they have to be justified on good grounds. Some kinds of rights are not of that kind. So, for example, you can't bring forward any justification for torture. Right? So there's no balancing going on there. But most rights involve a degree of balance between the right and the public interest, broadly. So that's one kind of conflict. The conflict that you're talking about, or that your question is talking about, is another kind of conflict, where there's a conflict between rights. So, for example, as in Asher's, there is a conflict between non-discrimination rights and freedom of expression rights. Yeah. And we may come on to that. The question that your questioner is asking is an even more interesting a set of conflicts, where you've got a conflict within the right itself between two dimensions of the right. In this case, two dimensions of the equality right, between the equality in terms of gender and equality in terms of religion. So that's a conflict within the right itself. So the question then is, how does one resolve those conflicts, whether between rights or within rights? And there are various techniques that are adopted within the legal context. So one technique that's used is that you may have a priority of one set of rights over another. So for example, in practice, though, you know, not in theory, we're not supposed to admit that this is what happens, but it does happen. For example, the right not to be tortured has priority over, in certain contexts, a positive duty on the state to prevent loss of life. Right. So, in other words, you're not allowed to torture somebody, even though in torturing them you may save somebody's life. That's a prioritization of one right over another. Within equality, we're in, to be honest, the early stages of trying to resolve those kinds of conflicts, because they haven't normally been presented in that way before. A lot of the cases that are coming up now do present that. So within, for example, a case that I did in the European Court of Human Rights, the Liddell case, which was in the English context, which was this case about a marriage registrar in Islington who refused to conduct same-sex civil partnerships and was sacked. And she went to the European Court of Human Rights, and we were representing her. So in that context, we explicitly framed the question as a conflict within equality, because we were saying she was being discriminated against on religious grounds, contrary to the convention. The opposition was saying, well, but if we allowed her not to conduct same-sex civil partnerships, that was going to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. So it was a conflict within equality, rather similar to the one that your questioner is dealing with. Now, you know, the technique that the European Court of Human Rights adopted in solving that dispute was one that we found deeply unsatisfactory, which was, they said, they invoked a doctrine called the doctrine of the margin of appreciation. And that basically means that, from the European Court of Human Rights' point of view, there are certain questions and certain tensions and certain conflicts that are essentially within the domain of a nation state. And we as the Court of Human Rights are not going to interfere with that. However, they decided to resolve that tension at the national level was okay with them. So they didn't actually get into the question of how they would have resolved it. They simply said, that's the kind of question that is better dealt with at the local level or at the domestic level. So that's one approach. I think generally unsatisfactory, but that's often used. Another approach is to invoke something like human dignity. So in other words, what you say is, these two rights that are in conflict are both said to derive from a notion of dignity, a kind of meta-principle. And the question then is how to resolve that tension in a way that best comports with satisfying the principle of human dignity. Yeah? So that then gets into difficult territory, obviously, because it precisely involves the question, for example, between sexual orientation discrimination and religious discrimination, how far you think that the protection of someone's sexual identity is more important than the protection of their religious identity. Now, in that context, this gets us immediately into what I call the, rather grandiosely, the epistemological problem, right? Because the court is then having to say, well, we understand and empathize and sympathize and understand entirely the trauma, the harm, the hurt that those who have a particular sexual orientation that they're not able to express feel. But these religious law, we don't actually understand you very much. What, you know, what exactly are you on about? And that then creates an immediate problem, because the group that is most empathized with is one that's generally associated with modernity. And so, particularly if you don't understand the other person, the other group, you're going to not give them full rein. So, the short answer is there are many ways in which these tensions are addressed, not always very satisfactorily. That's why engagement with these questions, the more you can, for example, engage with this kind of question, the more likely it is that you will articulate why your particular viewpoint is important in a way that comports with the notion of public reason, which can then be translated into judicial talk. So what I'm suggesting is that a discourse, particularly a religious discourse, that tends to use private language, that tends to use language that is understandable that sends signals to the group of believers, but doesn't necessarily translate into public reason, is going to harm your argument. By the way, the effect of that is, and this is a really deleterious effect. The effect of that is to privilege those religions that do articulate their reasons in the form of public reason, and to disadvantage those religions that don't. So, for example, in terms of a dialogue between, as it were, Presbyterians and Catholics, Catholics often tend to articulate these arguments in terms of reason. Whereas another group of religious believers who articulated them in terms of revelation is just going to have a much more difficult time to establish their argument before a court. That's the reality.
Anybody want to?
Just picking up on your point about the epistemological point, to what extent does that unveil the secular state as not the secular state, in the sense that...
I didn't catch the first bit, sorry.
This is in reference to your epistemological argument, yeah. To what extent does that reveal that the secular state is not the secular state, in this sense, that secular judges, for example, are saying this is central to your religious practice or this is not central to your religious practice, but are they not then acting as essentially theologians and not secular?
No, that's a great question. Let me give an example of where it came up in a recent case. Another case I was involved with, right? Was a case called JFS, which involved a young boy who claimed to be Jewish, who was seeking admission to a school in London, Jewish school in London, state school, but a Jewish school. And he wore a kippah, he kept kosher, he was learning Hebrew, etc., etc. Went to synagogue, kept Shabbat. But he was born of a Jewish father, but a non-Jewish mother. Even more complicated, actually, the mother was Italian Catholic, but had converted to Judaism, but had converted under non-Orthodox principles. So she had converted under Mizorti, which is kind of conservative Judaism. The Orthodox chief rabbi didn't recognize the conversion, and therefore he was excluded from the school because he wasn't Jewish. And he took a case, and we were defending the school. And we lost because the court decided that it was discrimination against him on ethnic grounds, not on religious grounds, but on ethnic grounds. And the reason why it was discrimination on ethnic grounds was because, and this comes back to your point, the court interpreted what was going on as not central to the religious dimension of Judaism, as opposed to the ethnic dimension of Judaism. Yeah? So this was a clear example where the court was receiving evidence as to what the religion, from our point of view, required, and the court saying to the Jewish community in London, no, that's not how we understand what's going on. Now, from that point of view, of course, not surprisingly, the Orthodox Jewish community that we were in part representing were tearing their hair out because they're saying they just don't understand what it means to be Jewish. Right? It's nothing to do with practice. It's to do with partly identity, partly descent. That's what it means to be Jewish. You may not like that, the Supreme Court, but that's the way it is. That's a religious understanding, and the court says no. Really what the court did, and I've written about this, really what the court did was to adopt quite a Protestant understanding of what it meant to be religious, right? Which was, it was all about doctrine, it was all about choice, it was all about what you believed. And that wasn't what was going on in the Jewish understanding. So it was that was the trigger for me to say there's a problem here in terms of this epistemological issue. So coming to then to your question, is this a demonstration of the non-neutrality of the state? I'm not sure it is. Initially, at least, it's a problem of lack of understanding. They think they're being neutral, but the lack of understanding means that they just sometimes, and from our point of view, just made a mistake. There is a deeper sense, however, in which it may be non-neutral, and that is the default position is increasingly assumed to be a non-religious position. So what it is to be reasonable is often, more often than not, is not to be religious. And from that point of view, therefore, neutrality is seen to be, or is thought to be, the exclusion of religion. So in other words, creating a neutral space in the public sphere is the exclusion of religion from that public sphere. That is neutrality. And for those who think it appropriate for religion to be in the public sphere, and that's increasing, then it's clearly a non-neutral position.
Chris, let me try one more. Instinctively not as indefinable and controversial as human rights. Also, is it not the case that defining human rights in terms of dignity is a tautology?
Mm. The short answer to the second question is no. But let me start with the first question, and I'll come to the second one. So, is human dignity controversial? Is it vague? Yes. Is it as controversial as human rights? I think probably not. In the sense that, let's make a party political point. So the government, the United Kingdom government, is hostile to the European Convention on Human Rights. It has yet to decide it's going to come out against human dignity, and I don't think that's going to happen. I've yet to see any placards out on the streets protesting against human dignity. So for the moment at least, it remains a kind of umbrella consensus term. That's not to say that it's empty, but it is capacious. And capacious in different ways. That's why you have different conceptions of it. So is it as controversial? No, I don't think it is. It may become as controversial. So for example, there are approaches within feminism that would be very hostile to the notion of human dignity because they perceive it as being potentially weakening of equality and potentially in particular imposing notions of duties to oneself, which is a whole other story that we can get into. So there are, at the margins, there are those who are thinking that human dignity may and should be rather controversial. But that isn't the mainstream position at the moment, whereas human rights is deeply controversial. Is it, simply a way, as it were, of shifting the controversy from human rights to human dignity? And the answer is no, because it plays a different function in the structure of human rights thinking. In other words, human dignity is the meta-principle which informs human rights, which are much more specified and concretized. Human dignity is not created by the state. Human rights are. And so there's a different architecture. Dignity fits into the architecture rather differently. Are they a tautology? For that reason, it's not a tautology. In other words, human rights are deriving from dignity rather than simply being the same as dignity. Well, that's sort of the $64,000 question, isn't it? I want to be quite careful in answering this, because I think it's a serious question, and potentially for some in the audience, quite a lot may ride on the answer to this. So I think the answer is no, not yet. In other words, are there opportunities to influence human rights decision-making, including at the state level? And the answer is yes, I think there are. And so from that point of view, I'm still wedded to the notion that engagement is absolutely vitally important. And that it's because of non-engagement that you're more likely to get results that will then push you further into the margins. Is it inevitable that you are going to succeed by that engagement in the sense of protecting your values? No, there's no guarantee of that at all. And one of the worrying things, I have to say, since we're going to be ending on this note perhaps, one of the worrying things is the rise and success of populism. It's that, I think, rather than the nature of the state, that now I think potentially is extremely dangerous to some of the values that you share with others. We should be very, very worried, in particular, by notions that religion can, and religious believers can ride populism and control it. And I think that in the States, that's partly what was going on. The assumption, I have to say, and with due respect, if the polls are correct, that the majority of evangelicals voted for Donald Trump is, I think, a very worrying phenomenon, in the sense that the impression is being given that there is, in some sense, a religious backing to this. And if that's not the case, and the idea is simply, well, he'll come into line, you know, we should be worried about the notion that we can control populism. Once it's out of the bag, I think it is extremely dangerous to the values that we hold dear. So I don't think it's the state that's the problem. I think it's that populism is the problem. And in fact, it may be the weakness of the state to be able to control populism that is also the problem.